You're listening to the Divorce and Your Money Show. I'm your host, Sean Lehman, MBA and Certified Divorce Financial Analyst. You can learn more about us at divorceandyourmoney.com. One of the most common and most popular questions I get from a lot of you, both by email and just from the most popular episodes I see on the show and from my one-on-one coaching sessions is my spouse hiding money from me? Well, it's a very tricky question, and there's sometimes pretty obvious ways that your spouse is hiding money and sometimes less obvious. But today I wanted to just get some information directly from a forensic accountant. So I interview a very experienced forensic accountant out in California. His name is Mark Cohn, and he has a book. I'm going to put the link in the show notes, but you should really check out his book. It's called How They Stash the Cash, A Guide to Finding Income Hidden by a Spouse During Divorce. And what's interesting about his book is that he covers a series of stories from his career of different ways that spouses have tried to hide money that he's been able to investigate. And we're not just talking about, you know, offshore accounts or something super sexy. We're talking about things for like doctors and lawyers and accountants and business people. And if you own a retail store, whatever the case may be, Mark has seen it all over a 28-year career, so be sure to check out his book, How They Stash the Cash, and he's going to talk us through some of the important issues that you should think about if you need a forensic accountant or you're considering a forensic accountant for your divorce case. So listen to this great interview with Mark Cohn. Today, I have on the show with me Mark Cohn. He's a forensic accountant and author of How They Stash the Cash, A Guide to Finding Income Hidden by a Spouse During Divorce. Mark, welcome to the show.
Hello. Fine, thank you.
So, Mark, why don't you give the audience a little bit about your background, and you have quite a number of degrees and qualifications, so it'd be good to give us a little bit of an intro about yourself.
I have been doing this for around 28 years, forensic accounting and divorce, and that includes business valuations because the two go together. The determination of income goes together with the value of the business. So, and usually the kind of cases I get are cases involving potentially unreported income. And to the extent there's unreported income, to that extent, the value of the business goes higher. And in California, which is a community property state, we call that the outspouse, the non-working spouse, is entitled to basically 50% of the value of the business. Unless the business was started before marriage, which gets more complicated, but there's two major things that go on in every case in California is how much money does a spouse earn and what's the value of that spouse's business. And to the extent you find hidden income, so the income goes up, so child and spousal support goes up, and the value of the business goes up. And sometimes there is unreported income and sometimes there's not. There's no guarantees. I never make any promises. But that's what I do, basically, is I look for what's the income of the person, and how does that affect the value of the business? That's the two major assignments that go on in most cases.
Right. And if someone wants to hire you, how do they, what are the signs that there might be hidden income? Do they know in advance, or is it obvious, or sometimes is it trickier? How do you figure that out? Or, even think to contact you?
Right. There's two things. If people don't hire me, officially they do. My engagement letter is with people, but it's lawyers who hire me. And if somebody calls me from the blue, I tell them that their lawyer should call me, because the lawyers are used to working with forensic accountants that they work with. So even if sometimes it happens that the client would hire me and tell their lawyer to hire me, but I'm just telling you, the procedure usually is the lawyer tells the client, you must hire Cohn. So that's the procedure. But then the second question you asked is, how do you know or what makes you think there's unreported income? Sometimes it's easy as could be. Sometimes that the wife or the husband, the outspouse has copies of the tax return. I've had cases like this where the reported adjusted gross income, let's call it, or net income, the total income is, let's say, $50,000 a year, and they live in a $5 million home, and they both drive top-of-the-line Mercedes, and they vacation in cruises all around the world, and they live a very wealthy lifestyle, but the tax return shows basically poverty. So those are the great cases. But then the trick is to prove that, to prove there's unreported income. And as it looks like unreported income, it smells like it, but you got to prove it then. And that could be challenging.
So what kind of documents or support do you look at to determine if there might be hidden income? Or also I'm trying to get at is, what should someone kind of have prepared for you?
Well, that's the hard part, because the starting part they should have is, let's say, the personal tax return and just the description of their lifestyle. If somebody says, here's my tax return that shows low income, and they describe a lifestyle that shows wealthy, then I say, you seem to have a good case. That's it. The details of how to find how they're hiding the income, the client, who's usually the outspouse, doesn't have those records. We have to subpoena those records.
Right. So, it can be a little bit of a fishing expedition, it sounds like.
It's very much a fishing. And the one case I had that was extraordinary, just so you know, is that, and they went to the Court of Appeals and they upheld it, where the husband refused to provide any records, or the record, he provided records showing tax returns of very low income, and then he refused to provide any other records, and the lawyers working with filed a motion to compel, and they refused to comply, so he didn't do anything, and there was like zero records, and my lawyer said, just do whatever you do. I don't know. I give up, sort of. And I asked the client for photos. And the client gave me a million photos of the Mercedes and the BMW and the huge swimming pool and the horse and the racing car, and everything else. And I just prepared a declaration with all those photos. And I said, to have this, you have to earn at least so much money. And they reduced it, et cetera. And therefore, I said, therefore, the value of the business is so much. And therefore, his income is so much. And the trial court agreed with it. And the Court of Appeals agreed with it. So sometimes you end up in a case where there are literally like no records. But you have to sometimes work around that. But it's hard if the judge is new on the bench and doesn't know what they're doing and they're not confident. That's the tricky part. It's, convincing the judge is sometimes challenging.
That's a good segue you said that particularly in California, there may have been a lot of turnover lately amongst some of the judges, and that occurs across the country, just given the workload and some of the craziness involved in family law and family court. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your experiences with judges? Do they understand what's going on? Do they care? How does that relationship work, and what you've seen over the past almost three decades?
Yeah, if the judges have been there for a few years, they've seen lots of examples of unreported income. They understand it, they believe it, and they relate to it. But the judges who came from criminal, but civil, and so they worked their whole lives as a partner in a huge law firm, and they themselves reported all their income because they had to, because they get K-1s from these partnerships. They themselves report their income, and they're just not, when they're new on the bench, they don't relate to this idea of people having massive unreported income. They can think in their minds of unreported income as being a $200 something, But I've had cases where the people reported 100,000 and didn't report 900,000. You know, so they're reporting 10%. That's like, it's so hard for the new judges to understand. They don't believe it. So when they get a case like that, they think their initial reaction is the forensic is out of his mind. Or he's being paid, not that he's being bribed, but he's trying to satisfy somebody like the lawyer, and he's concocting crazy theories. So, but after a few years on the bench, they say they've heard already hundreds of these cases and stuff. They, you know, and so at that point, they don't even believe any tax return. But it's a migration over the time. But usually, lately, they leave within a year. So by the time they're getting close to having some understanding, they're gone. So then you get a new judge, and so it's rough.
So, you know, what do you recommend in those situations for the attorneys and the clients whom you represent, you know, who you help? Do you tell them, you know, it's not worth it, or you tell them it has to be an egregious example to pursue, or how do you handle that?
Right, that's exactly what I try to do. Now, see, I'm just an accountant. They even say it sort of. I'm just an accountant. I'm a nobody on the scheme of things. The main driver is to some extent the client, and to a large extent the lawyer. Sometimes the lawyer just wants to, for whatever reason, either because they personally feel there's an injustice going on, or if subconsciously they just need some extra billing. You never know. But sometimes the driver quite often is the lawyer. And they'll just say, we're going to pursue justice even if we bankrupt a client. They don't say it that way, but I've seen that happen. But so my opinion is just an opinion. It's not the driving force. But if I see that it's a difficult case to prove, I tell everybody, this will be difficult. And if it's difficult, it's expensive. And are you sure it's worth it? You see, so some cases you can tell it's going to be difficult, and other cases you can tell right away this is easy. You can just see almost, but I mean, I can look at certain tax returns and I can say instantly that's where the unreported income is. He has fake deductions, and you can see it. Look on page 8. It's right there, just about. You know, I mean, you can almost see it. So what I do initially is I give it an initial look through, and I give the feedback to the lawyer saying, this is either easy or it's hard, etc. You know, so, and sometimes my opinion doesn't matter anyway. They say, well, we'll do the best we can, or we'll do this, whatever. So, but you can, some cases you can see that this looks like it's going to be easy. I mean, easy to prove to a judge. And other cases look like it's going to be very difficult, and maybe just try to settle and do the best you can. So it's not a black and white situation.
Right. And do you work with other professionals, like maybe a private investigator for some of your cases when you're looking into things?
Well, I never work with private investigators. If you read my book, I highly recommend private investigators. They're phenomenal. The ones who are good are great, but they often do things illegally. I don't want to say it that way because I don't know, but sometimes I do know. But they sometimes do things illegally. Like sometimes they'll go through the trash, and the trash is located in a place where they're not really allowed to go, and they get it anyway. So when that happens, I am given information. I'm given like sanitized information from the lawyer that take a good closer look at the Wells Fargo account, you know, or whatever. You know, there might be stuff like that. Or what often happens is they go, let's say the trash, they'll find the trash and they'll find something interesting. So then the lawyer will know, he's got an account at this funny bank, this strange bank over here. So then the lawyer subpoenas that bank, and then the return of subpoena is given to me. So I'm never aware that there's a private investigator. And so you remember, I have no privilege. So if there would be a private investigator and who's doing something illegal, and that shows up in my emails, so that the whole case can fall apart, because then it becomes disclosed that that illegal stuff was being done. So private investigators are wonderful, but I never talked to them.
Fair enough.
And I've been in cases where they're used, but I don't talk to them. Like on one case I was on, it was great, and the case settled purely because of the private investigator. And for a little bit of time, I was getting copies of the trash. And then I was advised that you will never again see it because they moved the trash into a different location. And now they're still getting the trash, but illegally. So I was cut off from the trash.
Right. And so for the people who are not in California, are there certain qualifications that they should look for when hiring a forensic accountant or considering a forensic accountant?
They should look for somebody with experience. It's hard. It's like not nice to say that the people who are starting out, they unfortunately have to get the experience. But without experience, you don't know what you're doing. And so you could be floundering around and looking at a million things and just wasting time. I mean, I'll just give you one example. I once had a case, I won't go into the whole details, but there was a document production in a law firm. I went to the law firm and I was sent to a big room, and there was like 60 some boxes in the room. They said, here, go through them. Here's the documents you asked for, 60 some boxes. And now if I was a junior accountant and stuff, I would go through all 60 boxes and spend like 3 weeks and send this horrendous bill to the client and go nowhere with the thing. But I had a funny feeling. I said, I know what I need and I know what I don't need. And like 30 boxes I did in 1 hour. It was just printouts and stuff. I don't need that. And then I actually found a critical document showing that as an old document, like 40 years old, that proved a certain legal theory. And within like 2 or 3 hours, I found that document, which I didn't expect to find. I copied it and I went home, and the case settled like a week later because that proved the whole point. You see? But somebody who didn't know what they're doing would have gone through all 60 boxes and been worn out completely, never even noticed that old piece of paper. And so you have to find somebody who's been doing it for a bunch of years till you get a feeling for where is the waste of time and where is not the waste of time.
I'm saying
one of the maneuvers is to drown you in with nonsense. And if you don't know what you're doing, I get a return on subpoenas. So I got a return recently from Wells Fargo, 20,000 pages, return on subpoena.
Wow.
Now, I mean, if you don't know what you're doing, you can. It takes a long time to go to 20,000 bank statements. You know what I mean? And that's just one return. And so, either you have a system of doing this efficiently, or else you'll. Because if you just waste time, then you get drowned in the trees and you miss the forest. So that's the problem.
And in addition to experience, are there certain academic or credentials that a forensic accountant should have?
Well, that's an interesting question. You should have a credential so that when you're cross-examined, they cannot impeach you by saying that you're not qualified. So I have like 2 credentials in business valuation, just so that when I value a business, nobody will question my competence. And I am a certified fraud examiner because I was once cross-examined and I asserted fraud, and the lawyer asked me, are you a certified fraud examiner? I mean, how could you assert fraud if you're not certified to certify? And I said, no, at the time I answered, I'm not a certified fraud examiner. But within a week, I started the process of becoming one. So now there are many of my, I guess you call it competitors, who have very few credentials. But they've been doing it for 25 years, and everybody knows that they're competent. And so everybody stipulates their competence. But if you're new at it, then there's no reason why anybody should accept your opinion. So if you're starting out relatively, you're new at it, I recommend getting at least one credential in business valuation and becoming a certified fraud examiner.
And then one last question before we wrap up, but are there some common recurring themes you see for how spouses might hide income from each other? I mean, you said it's obvious, or it can be obvious, when the income doesn't match the lifestyle. Are there other things that people should keep a lookout for that might indicate that something's a little bit off?
There's two basic ways of hiding income. I mean, in the business, that's where the real action usually is. And I tell lawyers, in fact, as far as my experience is, that most people do one or the other. They don't do both because it's mentally hard to do both. But the two basic things they do is either they don't report the gross income, or they inflate their expenses. So you can have somebody, because some businesses more or less have to report all their income. All their income is paid by credit card. So like the income, or they get paid by check. You can still maneuver with all that. There's still plenty of room to maneuver, but so those people, their receipts is sort of locked in, or it's reported in some way. It's on paper. It's visible. So they will very often then inflate their expenses. They will have business. They will pay for every personal expense through their business. And many spouses know that. They actually know. They say our vacations are paid by the business. Our medical expenses are paid by the business. Our clothing is paid by the business. I mean, I've seen businesses where the kids, the whole household's clothing is paid by the business. And on the business tax return, it's called uniform expense. You see? And so you can tell, you know, so uniforms. And then you look at the general ledger and you see it's all payments to Nordstrom. That's kind of funny that Nordstrom is selling uniforms. I mean, it's obviously not. But so the two approaches, either their expenses are packed with personal items, and for that you need the general ledger, and otherwise it's their gross income that's not being reported. And that's a harder, that's hard to do. That's more difficult, but that can be done.
No, that's very helpful for people to kind of keep an eye out for. And Mark, what's the best way for people to contact you?
The best way that I prefer is with email, mark@cohncpa.com.
That's K-O-H-N.
Right, cpa.com.
Excellent. Well, Mark, thank you very much for being on the show.
Okay, my pleasure.